Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Business Roundtable. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Another down week on Wall Street on tech tumbles and worries about a wider war in the Middle East. 8 months late, Congress passes a $95 billion supplemental package for Ukraine, Israel, and Gaza, and better preparing to counter China. More U.S. tariffs on Chinese steel and aluminum as Washington again warns Beijing about helping Moscow's Ukraine war. Boeing workers testified before a Senate committee on production quality problems. After United's turn in the safety barrel, now American airline pilots are sounding the alarm about their carrier's safety and maintenance. And Britain considers new warships. Joining me today to discuss all this and more are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Securities, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London, and Richard Abalafia of the Aerodynamic Advisory Consultancy. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program. It is an honor and pleasure having you all on. As always, Ron, as usual, start us off. Kind of a tough week on Wall Street. You know, we've been talking about the VIX index and worries. Last week, we had Iran's unprecedented attack on Israel with more than 300 ballistic and cruise missiles, as well as drones. And then this week, we also had Israel's response striking a facility in Isfahan, near the nuclear facility, but a message delivered in terms of its precision strike capability. Either way, not a particularly good one for the Iranian regime. And both sides have signaled it's time now to go back to the proxy war that they've been fighting as opposed to duking it out directly. Anyway, walk us through the week on the street. Inflation's been running hotter than people expected. That means the Fed's not going to cut rates. There were a whole bunch of things that float in people's minds when they're making investment decisions. Anyway, walk us through what it meant for aerospace and defense.
Yeah, so the S&P was down about 3% on the week. Our group broadly outperformed. The names that are recognized as higher beta names did not, but that's to be expected. Boeing was roughly flat. Lockheed Martin was up 3%, so that's kind of pretty significant outperformance. Northrop Grumman, Raytheon were both about up 1.5%. General Dynamics was roughly flat. And when you look at the names that underperformed, Embraer was down about 5%. Spirit AeroSystems was down about 4%. Rocket Lab was down about 5%. They tend to be higher beta names, and that's what you'd expect to see. Like you mentioned, the VIX index continues to climb. It's around 19 now. If you remember, just a short little while ago, it was down by 10. And it's been in this range between, call it 10 and 20. 20 is a higher measure of fear. The 10-year was relatively stable this week, but has been trending higher. This week, we actually at one point went over 4.7%, trending back to that kind of 4.8 to 5% range where we were before. All based on expectations. Is the Fed going to cut? Is it not going to cut? And there was headlines out this week basically highlighting, the Fed's going to cut, but maybe not this year, right? So we've seen that change. And then finally, crude oil, given everything that's been going on in the world, has been relatively stable. WTI, $83, Brent crude, $87. It did touch 90 at one point, but pulled back. And then Boeing is still holding at the third worst performing stock in the S&P year to date.
Real quick, because we're going to talk about Ukraine aid and all of the money that is included in that, which is a lot of industrialization and facilitization for the United States for, refilling magazines and the like. Is that, sort of $95 billion, the vast preponderance of which is going to go to U.S. industry, is that already baked in to the stocks at this point, or do you expect to see a bit of a rally next week when folks?
Yeah, I don't think it is. Our view was that it was going to happen. We've been talking about that for a while. We were expecting about $100 billion supplemental with a lot of noise. I think the street was not expecting that. So we'll see how things go. The way defense trades, clearly this will be a nice tailwind for the defense names in the U.S. and maybe even outside the U.S. But that being said, the bigger macro driver will be expectations around the Fed. And you really have seen this almost schizophrenic market where one day it's like, yeah, the Fed's going to cut, next day it's not. So we'll see. So, you know, this week, if we don't have a broader macro concerns, then we'll see. Now, this week is also a complicated week because we've got a lot of companies reporting earnings. So the the aerospace and defense and broader industrial earnings kicks off this week in a big way, this week and next week. So you're going to have a lot of company specific news. So if one of the defense companies comes out and has a really bad quarter, that probably won't bode well for the rest of them. If one has a really good quarter, that probably will bode well for the rest of them. I think what's interesting, however, going into the quarter, the setup, as they kind of say in the Wall Street jargon, is pretty fascinating, right? I mean, there's a lot of high expectations on commercial aftermarket and commercial aerospace names, but at least in the U.S., this side of the Atlantic, not very high expectations on defense. And if you look at where outlays have gone and now what's going on with the budget, it's actually a pretty positive setup for defense into the quarter, most likely.
And what are your just overall expectations for the group when they start reporting earnings? Let's just get that out of the way now.
Yeah, I think we'll see very, very solid aftermarket growth, particularly for the engine manufacturers. That actually might not be the case for Pratt & Whitney because of some complications around the GTF and what's going on with the the powdered metal issue and replacing the discs and so on and so forth. But everything tied to CFM and other engines, should the aftermarket should be really, really good. I would expect outside of the engine sphere, really good aftermarket numbers as well. And then on defense, my guess will be, and we'll see how it goes, that top lines will be pretty good and investors will be very focused on margins and then also backlog. And I would imagine backlogs would be pretty good too, given what's going on with the budget, given what's going on with outlays, and now kind of where expectations are. I would imagine there might be some room for some positive surprises in defense.
And do you expect to see margin pressure, which is something folks have talked about, or do you think that that's maybe a little premature?
No, we could, right? I mean, everybody, it's interesting how it was all sort of framed. Everybody's blaming this on Boeing, poor Boeing. That, they bought these contracts with fixed price contracts, all the programs we know, and that kind of forced everybody else to do it. I don't necessarily believe that, but we'll see. We know where the suspects are, right? I mean, Northrop Grumman's got, the LRIP on the B-21. Raytheon's got some stuff in their missile business. Lockheed's got some stuff in their missile business. Boeing's got all the high profile programs we spoke about. L3 Harris has their handful. So we'll see how it all goes. But I think that cat's already out of the bag. So we know that now it's, do margins actually start to improve with increased volume? Maybe. But like I said, expectations aren't very high. And, the Wall Street game is all about expectations. It's really not about reality, but it's about expectations, right? So
yeah, exactly.
Expectations aren't very high.
Look, all I have to say about the suppliers, I mean, I understand that they signed up for stuff and, partnering for success meant beating the daylights out of your subcontractors. But like anything, whether you're making potato chips or you're making titanium or, anything else, if you can charge more money, you're going to charge more money. And you'll charge as much money as the market will bear for that, right? So, alas, Adam Smith 101. Sash, walk us through how the group performed in Europe. Certainly, I mean, I don't want to say positive trends, but I mean, there are positive trends that, there was an excellent story in Le Monde about how France is putting a lot of money into its defense industrial base. 210,000 jobs in France, I think, for a country of around 65, 68 million. A lot of people will be kind of surprised. It's a pretty robust group. Anyway, walk us through in terms of what you sort of see as the big drivers and how the group performed this week.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it's a pretty tough week in Europe. And I think what this was a reflection of the fact there's been quite a lot of profit taking in the defense group. So, this fairly much mirrors what Ron is saying, that I think expectations for the defense group for the Q1s, which are in about the next 3 weeks or so, are not high. And investors who've had a very dry this year so far have just been taking money off the table. So the overall European aerospace and defense sector off about 3.1%. Civil stocks are off about 2%, and the defense stocks are off about 3.5%, 3.5, 4. And within that, the two big fallers were Rheinmetall down 7% and Hensoldt down 6%. Now, you know, they've both been up over 50%, in Rheinmetall's case, over 75% this year alone. And share prices are up 2 or 3 and 4 times since the invasion of Ukraine. So, taking a bit of money off, just going risk off here, it doesn't seem a terribly unwise thing to do. Just to give an idea of the sort of colour that companies have been talking about in their investor meetings since the full year results, the defence companies have really been emphasising that, as almost every other normal year, stuff tends to be heavily weighted in terms of deliveries, in terms of cash flow, in terms of profitability to the second half of the year and to particularly to the fourth quarter. So don't expect anything terribly exciting in the first quarter. Frankly, companies spend so much time and effort trying to get orders over the line in December so that they can, you know, report blowout numbers for orders, backlog, book to bill for the full year, that they tend to be exhausted in January and February, and then sort of things pick up again in March. So Q1's never a terribly exciting quarter, but I think that, you know, the evidence that investors are taking money off the table is absolutely there. And I suspect we'll see a little bit more of the same this week.
And we're going to get to Ukraine spending in just a moment, and the impact that it's going to have in Europe as well, even as Europe tries to stand up its own industrial capabilities for reasons political as well as domestic. But Richard, right? I mean, one of our perennial unfortunate topics is the decoupling between China and the United States. In some cases, that's positive. In other cases, it's somewhat not as positive. Is there, you know, Antony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, is going to be the latest U.S. official to engage with Chinese leaders. He's going to be visiting Beijing next week. There, he's going to try to make the case that China not help Russia in its war on Ukraine. The Chinese are supplying both sides, even if they are supplying one side far, far more than the other in terms of the Russian side. The Secretary of State talked about machine tools and the like. The administration has put new tariffs, right? A bad old idea that's back in full force in Washington. And then when Washington does it, everybody else is going to do it as well on steel and aluminum. But, you know, and now we're talking about decoupling on medical devices as well and on pharmaceuticals. I mean, that's kind of logical in the wake of, unfortunately, the pandemic, you know, but also legitimate concerns about how the Chinese collect data and use the data on Americans, especially health data. What goes through on this latest sort of decoupling tariffist snapshot? And whether the United States has, you know, like China has any interest at a time when its economy is hurting and it's partnered with Russia, North Korea, and Iran. I mean, are they going to actually stop shipping anything to Russia if we ask them even very nicely?
Yeah, you know, I just don't think it's realistic to stop this unpleasant process. You know, it's on many different levels in many different directions. You know, the Russia-China alliance is cynical, fragile, but for now it works. I don't think they're going to stop. The most you can say for it, the best thing you can say from the U.S. perspective, is that so far it doesn't involve the sort of North Korea, let's ship them all of our artillery shells, let's ship them, you know, I don't know, engine parts, whatever. That's good. it hasn't gotten to that point. And, you know, there are a number of other levers the U.S. could pull in the event that they do that, that would, you know, I think be unpleasant, but understandable. I've argued and others have argued that we could just cut off their transport sector. We could cripple their national jetliner programs, all these other options in the event that they do start shipping weaponry. But for now, it's just an economic alliance with, you know, an occasional adjacency on the defense side. You know, but what really hits you looking at the broader political and economic landscape is just how much potential there is for making things that much more severe and decoupling. You know, the TikTok thing hasn't kicked in yet. It will. Aluminum and steel, it will. You know, then perhaps, you know, most of all, you've got, you know, the Chinese reaction. And also, frankly, you've got this kind of irreconcilable you know, two impulses coming from the Biden administration. One, they want a green economic agenda, which means Well, electrification, particularly cars. On the other hand, you've got the threat of cheap imports of Chinese electric vehicles, which have gotten a lot better and a lot more, cheaper over the past couple of years. It's pretty remarkable. So you do what's the right thing from the right from a green agenda perspective, or do you do the right thing from a jobs and domestic industry protection perspective? I don't think that's been decided yet, but yet we all know it'll probably be decided in favor of domestic protection. That's just the way it goes in an election year, right? So in other words, on an economics level, this gets worse, considerably worse this year. And again, there's the, what's the Chinese reaction? Will it be more rare earths? What will exactly happen here? But there's the potential for, just things entering a downward slide. Meanwhile, it's kind of interesting. One of, Trump needs money, lots of money. And one of his mega donors, John Paulson, has said, actually, our priority is preventing decoupling. So you might see a bit of a role reversal from the last election, where the Biden administration gets a bit more tariff friendly and protection friendly, whereas conceivably, Trump, in his desperate search for cash, becomes a bit more business friendly and maybe anti-decoupling or not as severe on decoupling, depending upon a million different other factors. But anyway, we're at a divergence point, I guess you could say.
I think it's incredible, but I mean, if you invest a lot of money, you end up getting a lot of return for it. And I am stunned at the quality of BYD cars. I was in Europe last year and rode around twice in cars that the minute I got into them, I was like, as a car guy, was like, holy crap, this is a neat car. Turned out it was BYD. Anyway, you have your pick. You can buy your electric car from China. Elon Musk. No, you can't. You have a lot more choice now, obviously, which is one of the reasons why I think Tesla is hurting a little bit. And unfortunately, the market is overall down. But we'll discuss that on a future show. Let's shift to war spending, because unfortunately, we don't have that much time, but we have a lot to discuss. Ron, unless anybody wants to weigh in on the China matter, I think Richard did a terrific job. Let's talk a little bit about war spending. I mentioned the great Le Monde article talking about how France is gearing up spending. And Washington just cleared, 8 months late, but cleared a supplemental spending package for Ukraine, Israel, Gaza, as well as the Indo-Pacific with, and if everybody calls it Taiwan, it's not fully for Taiwan. It's $95 billion, $61 billion is for Ukraine, $17 billion is for Israel, $9 billion is for humanitarian aid for Gaza, $8 billion is Indo-Pacific capabilities, of which about $1.9 billion is going to Taiwan. Of that, the overwhelming majority is being invested in the United States, right? I mean, you have $3 billion as part of the Asia spending. That's for the U.S. submarine industrial base. Of the Ukraine package, I think something like $48 billion or so dollars of that is for weapons to refill our own stocks. We've been sort of holding back because we're hitting the bottom of our barrels. This allows us to have a little bit more surety that stuff is going to be on order. By the way, all of this delays stuff that we should have done. Okay, we should have been doing this spending steadily 2 years ago, but you can't be on 6 month continuing resolutions and not have it leave a mark. Ron, from a industrialization standpoint, from a refilling of barrels standpoint, I mean, what does this do for the industry outlook now that this money is finally here? And it's a huge amount of money. It's a huge, huge amount of money.
Well, it's clearly good, right? I mean, let's just look at the submarine industrial base piece, $3.3 billion. And in that, you've got $1.9 billion, almost $2 billion in advanced procurement for Columbia-class submarines, $200 million advanced procurements for Virginia-class submarines. When you look at the submarine industrial base, my understanding is two big challenges are, A, the supply chain itself. So that you had a withering of that supply chain. So rebuilding that supply chain, and then just investments in the shipyards, and probably the most important piece is in labor, right? I mean, that the industry, and we've talked about this before,
right?
The entire industry in submarine industrial bases, immune from this, is just getting and retaining labor to build all this stuff, and that all has to be addressed now. Yeah, it's a bunch of money for the industry. The industry needs it. From that perspective, it's a good thing. I hope it gets deployed well. As you pointed out, it would have been nice to get it sooner, but we didn't. But here it is. So there you have it.
It's good. It is good. Of course, you also need more sort of, I think, sustained investment, which is something obviously clearly industry is looking at. And I've got a follow-up question to ask each of you in a moment about that. Sash, we have a tendency of looking at this as U.S. investment, and I know that there's a big debate in Europe, right? I mean, how much of it that European nations want homegrown? There was a great Financial Times article with Sylvia Pfeiffer and Henry Foy talking to Michael Johansson of the chief executive of Saab, saying, "Hey, you know, let's be careful and not create protectionism as we go about doing this." Right. I mean, historically, France has argued that everything that Europe buys should be made in Europe by European firms. There is even a debate about what qualifies as Europe. Right. I mean, now that, you know, there we've had Brexit, you know, some are making the case, hey, well, Britain is not part of that European defense industrial base, even if Britain is a key supplier to all of these companies, MBDA, right? I mean, the British heritage in that is very, very important. And Kevin Craven of ADS has made the case, hey, look, we're an integrated part of Europe's industrial base. You know, whether we're, you know, in the EU or not. Walk us through the importance of this spending on actually helping Europe bolster its own capabilities as well, because the United States never makes this innovation, this kind of investment, without it having actually direct implications for European military capabilities, considering NATO's our closest ally, or NATO nations are our closest allies.
Take it back just one step, first of all. But for our listeners, just put into perspective what $60 billion roughly buys Ukraine. Because some of the numbers are really quite interesting. We've done quite a lot of work on the cost of defending just Kyiv against Russian air attacks. And the numbers are that if Russia attacks Kyiv once a week with 50-odd missiles, cruise missiles, suicide drones, and so forth, and the Ukrainians are limited to firing a single missile per incomer, and they tailor that according to whether these are ballistic missiles, in which case they'll fire a Patriot or an Aster, or if these are cruise missiles, in which case they'll probably fire an ASAMS or a CAM or RST or something like that, or if these are relatively simple suicide drones, in which case they may tailor down. But just to defend Kyiv for a year, you don't get any change out of $4 billion. But here's the rub: you spend $4 billion on air defense missiles and guns and so forth to defend Kyiv, and you're firing one missile per incoming round, and you have a really bad attack like we had the other week, and the whole of Western Ukraine loses its power probably for 6 to 9 months, which shows you that that is not a sufficient defense anymore. So you have to fire two missiles per incomer, which is what a Western army would hope, or Air Force would hope, to fire anyway, and you're up to eight. And then you've got Odessa, so you're up to 10 billion. And we've got no budget yet for the cost of defending the Ukrainian front lines against glide bombs, against attack helicopters, and against, you know, all sorts of other bad things. So that 60 billion, it's possible to argue that nearly a quarter of that has to go just to air defenses, missiles, spare radars, you know, spare parts of every single sort, extra launchers, to keep or to keep Ukraine more or less intact and in relatively decent shape for the next year or so. That's an inc you know that and that's before you start. And then you've got artillery ammunition. It's about the same again, probably more. And all that does is to maintain the status quo. There's no thought. There's no budget in that for. You know, regaining Ukrainian territory. It's an incredibly expensive war when you look at it from the point of view of a supplemental here, a supplemental there, a bit of money from a European country here, a bit of money from another European country there. But you know, this is how it's being fought at the moment. So, what does the US spend? What does it do for Europe? Very, very little. What do the Europeans do for Europe? They're going through their own process, but. You know, there's the Henry Kissinger problem here, which is Europe is united geographically, but not a lot else. So the European Union is spending, paying direct money to Ukraine to keep the government afloat. Frankly, they just, you know, they pay over billions of euros, and that more or less keeps the Ukrainian government solvent because they've lost a lot of their economy to Russia. And then individual European countries are donating a few billions, but single-digit billions in any given year or so. And that adds up. And it's certainly over 25 billion, probably nearer 30 billion. But all this is doing is maintaining the status quo, no more than that. So really, the big number is 100 billion is what it takes to stop Russia and possibly improve the situation for the Ukrainians. But anything less than that, and what we're talking about is just slow loss. Economically, in terms of the defense industry, yeah, the European defense industry is beginning to spool up. But it takes a long time. It takes a long time in any Western economy to take an industry which politicians have zero funded for 30 years, and now they want to be producing at massive speed. I personally don't think that we should be, you know, I mean, I don't think the issues of nationalism, I think that's a distraction. Every European nation and the US can all afford to have munitions plants. They can all afford to make bits of missiles, and they should do, because we want as many sources as possible. The idea that there should be a single source for whatever it is, missiles, radars, or so forth. That's fine in peacetime. That's fine, post-Cold War. Now, we've got to have a multiplicity of sources. It doesn't matter how good or bad they are. Most of them probably won't be that good by the standards we've been used to, but they will produce stuff, and that is good enough.
Interesting point you're making, because at the same time, the U.S. is invigorating its capability, right? I mean, there are all these industrial meetings that are happening between U.S. and European, as well as our allies in the Indo-Pacific, to harmonize and make more common componentry to allow us to build this kind of stuff more quickly. So on the one hand, while the administration is is increasingly protectionist, it is talking about, building, it's talking about buying allied in many cases. I think we have to be much more direct in how we go about doing this. Don't necessarily force somebody to create a factory in the United States to supply U.S. components if it's certified. And we know that we like that part, whether it comes in the U.K., from France, Germany, Italy, or anywhere else. Richard, to bring this conversation over to you, we talked about one sort of bad idea, which is tariffs. And historically, we have come to look at government arsenals as bad, even though the U.S. system is actually based on it, right? Government-owned, contractor-operated is something, that we see both, when it comes to air production, when it comes to, munitions and weapons production as well. Sash, I'll come to you in just a moment. Are arsenals the right, and Ron, maybe get your sense on this as well. Are arsenals kind of something that we need to be thinking about in terms of having some sort of capacity and capability, valuing it differently and what its profit returns are and everything else to just augment it? Because I'm just saying, looking at Sash's great math, we're making about 500, if I understand this correctly, and I apologize if I'm screwing this wrong, because I had lunch with somebody who used the number 500 something Patriots. Are being produced a year now that we're putting some money into it. Okay, but we understand that that's insufficient for the needs of just one of the users of that system, as opposed to rebuilding our arsenals. And we will need many thousands, if not more, right? I mean, the number 7,000 has been used. I mean, you could argue you need to have far more than that, given the kind of encounters we're likely to try to protect ourselves from, especially given the kind of the scale of the Chinese missile arsenal. Richard, do we need to be considering arsenals at some point in an arsenal approach, or just facilitate more factories, but then private companies are going to complain about having this capacity and capability around, whereas the government has a tendency or greater willingness to sort of absorb lower rates in terms of just having resident capability? How do we need to maybe more creatively think about this?
Yeah, I think the fact that first and foremost, this sort of thinking is inevitable because there's this greater demand for sovereignty and capability. In the old days of the free market, and you keep things very tight in terms of capacity, just in the name of economic efficiency, those days are gone. We're moving towards an era where the state plays a more active role in defense capabilities. I remember just during what you might call the Tom Friedman years, it was all about, transnational entities, corporations, whatever. The governments, the states will gradually fade away. I think the state is sort of reasserting itself globally. Is this a good idea? You got to be careful. And I don't think we fully experimented with the kind of mechanisms like multi-year procurement contracts for missiles and munitions and other mechanisms that can be used to, you know, guarantee that capacity stays in place and yet still, you know, the free market system is allowed to prevail without distortions and whatever else. Should it happen? I don't really know. Will it happen? Yeah, it probably will, just because that's the way things are going in terms of thinking. But, you know, I would urge everyone to consider the great economist analogy of the windmill. You know, if there's a storm coming in, you let your windmill spin freely, it will be fine. If you fix it in place, it will be fine. It's when you slow it down, try to manage it and hold it up, that's when it rips itself apart in a storm. So in other words, whatever it is, we'd either have a full state-run arsenal system or a full free market industrial base and nothing but. The idea of something in the middle is probably inefficient and analogous to that managed windmill that's, you know, not very productive.
That was very Dutch of you, although I would say, you know, ultimately, we're in the pickle we're in because we were driving an industrial-based system for full efficiency, and it's inefficient. So you either pay or you're going to pay later, right? Or then you're going to get stuck without having enough shipyard capacity, yada, 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 right? I mean, the domino effect. And, you know, everybody blasts the Navy, and I can be critical about the Navy as well. On the other hand, a smaller Navy is spending more time underway. Deployments get extended because commanders want the presence. That ship misses its shipyard availability when, you know, and then it has a domino effect on maintenance and on, you know, the entire ecosystem. Sash, just be patient with me for a minute. Ron, let me, you know, kind of get your sense on this and where you think it should go. And then Sash, you can bring us home on this before we go to Boeing. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, so one of the factors you really have to keep in mind is labor. And, you know, we drew down production enough on submarines that, you know, trying to ramp it back up has become very difficult. But I mean, you know, when you think about, you know, the defense industry, it's really no different in commercial. Look at all the, you know, trouble Boeing has had on ramping 73 and 78 back up. A lot of that has to do with, you know, how low they got in production. In the case of 73, they actually stopped production. And, you know, disrupting the labor force like that is a difficult problem that you have to deal with. So when you look at the broader, either, you know, full market approach or sort of a managed industrial economy for defense, labor has to be a primary consideration.
I would point out that John Speller, the labor member of parliament, I remember when he was armed forces minister, was asking some of these questions of, isn't it better to have actually steady state production at a lower level so that at least we maintain that muscle memory and that capability, because at some point we're going to need more stuff, right? I mean, history never fully comes to an end. And again, there's a challenge, even though I think the UK on skills construction or you know, maintaining skills has done, I think, better maybe as a nationwide campaign, perhaps than we have. It's worth somebody to study. Sash, you've been very patient. Go ahead before we shift to the Boeing discussion briefly.
Yeah, I mean, look, that point of John Speller is touching, but it's naive. This has been a debate that governments have had about industry and how to fund industry. And I'm using industry with a, you know, very much lower case. It can be state, you know, government-owned, state-owned arsenals, or it can be companies or a mixture of both. But the brutal fact is that politicians and treasuries never, ever want to fund industry to maintain capacity in peacetime, because defense is seen by every treasury across the globe as being wasteful in peacetime. And then there is a crikey moment where it's realized that it's rather essential. But so I don't think we're going to see capacity maintained out of an act of charity by various treasuries, whether we like it or not. But I mean, to come back to, you know, the point about how do you expand capacity, and try to tie this into Ron's issue of labor. You get to a stage where it's very, very hard to recruit labor in any given area at the intensities that you need to double, triple, quadruple production. And the horrible truth is you need to take a bit more, you being a government, need to take a little bit more time and set up parallel factories, spare factories, or just buy different stuff. Don't go for the gold-plated, the perfect missile. buy every single thing you can on the basis, you know, I said, well, they may not be very good, but they're good. They will be good enough in and for a war. And I mean, you know, as an example, Second World War, the Britain alone had four different Spitfire factories, three of which were set up as shadow factories. They were effectively converted car companies just before the war. And they only ramped up by about 1941. But boy, they were doing great by 1944, knocking them out by the thousands. So if we want more air defense missiles, don't try to double production of too many of the existing plants, because you probably won't get the labor. You need to start upstream. We need more rocket motor facilities. We need a lot of dual sourcing. We then need shadow missile factories and more artillery factories, rather than trying to make million round factories and 2 million round factories. Because if you do that, you are concentrating. There's a hell of a lot of risk that something goes bang there, because it tends to in munitions factories if you expand too much. So build them elsewhere. Every single country, or in your case, every single state, probably needs an artillery or a missile factory or a rocket motor factory. It's a much better way of expanding at lower risk. It takes a bit longer, but that's a price that we have to pay now, because we've not spent the last 2 years terribly well.
I should also point out, right, I mean, automation and the right kind of automation is something you should be embracing in some of these fields, because we've really have an artisanal approach to some of this that you don't. That is just, I think, somewhat misguided, and I take your point. By the way, in defense of John, the point that he was trying to make was, this is what we should do. The likelihood of us being able to do it is not good, to your point, right? Treasuries have a tendency, unfortunately, in Europe especially, you have excess inventory, get rid of that excess inventory, as opposed to saying you're saving for a rainy day, right? And then all of a sudden you end up not having enough capability and capacity. All right, we're going into lightning round, because we've got a lot to discuss and not a lot of time to do it. Let's get to Richard, start us off. Boeing workers told the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee about the company's drive to increase production by taking production shortcuts, ignoring warnings from the workforce about quality problems on several programs. 787 has become sort of totemic on that. This testimony came as the Allied Pilots Association, that represents American Airlines pilots, warned that safety and maintenance issues are on the rise at American. And according to APA, the good thing is that management is taking those concerns seriously, evidently. Give us kind of a sense, because if you're the traveling public and you're listening to all of this, it's not good. But we're still waiting for a comment on the FAA on this. And I would have to say that the Boeing, it wasn't just a guy saying this, it was multiple people delivering this message, which then becomes problematic. And these people were not just sort of doofuses. They were people who the company considered to be kind of good employees, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. And of course, it all needs to be taken very seriously. Having said that, I'm not really sure what exactly is new. And we've known that there are very big issues with Boeing's quality culture and culture in general, big changes that need to be made. A lot of the issues raised, were the things that were highlighted when the FAA pulled the, production certification authorization from the 787 line a few years ago. That's all been, I would hope it's in the process of being dealt with by the regulators. But again, having said that, given the pressure that needs to be put on Boeing's management to completely change everything they've been doing and appoint people who were, how to put this, functioning adults in some cases, I'm glad to see the testimony. But I'm also concerned that there's a bit of a contagion on the traveling public that, hey, there's something new here. We've uncovered something fundamentally flawed with Boeing jets and how they're built. And, that's really just not the case. There's a culture issue that needs changing. There's many company issues that need changing, but I'm not sure that there's all of a sudden new evidence about serious technical flaws in how planes are designed or built.
Ron, and your quick take on this, and then one more question to each of you, and unfortunately we've got to end it there. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, to Richard's point, I don't know what new was really, really raised here. Just the sad reality, any points that were raised have to be taken serious, given Recent history. So can it be disruptive to what's going on at Boeing? Absolutely. But honestly, I don't know what was new.
I think I would say what was new was, instead of it just being a generalized sentiment, it was some specific things that everybody knew was an issue, but they were like, hey, we got to get these airplanes out the door. We, you know, even if they mean long-term problems, they'll get caught somewhere else, right? We'll get it at a D check or whatever. So I mean, I would say that from my standpoint jumped out. Ron, real quick, talk to us about Lockheed Martin's victory over Northrop with Raytheon for the $17 billion, the Missile Defense Agency's $17 billion Next Generation Interceptor Award. You know, I also think that it's an interesting development. I'm not trying to bust on Northrop. We're equal opportunity here. But it did seem like the company, you know, that Northrop was on a little bit of a run, but then it appeared to lose or place out of NGAD, decided to bet on FAXX, which looked pretty good. Then the Navy sort of, you know, indefinitely postponed that. Sentinel, really over budget. B-21, I mean, it's a new airplane, and it's actually appears to be doing well, but it has its own teething problems. Anyway, just talk to us about the win overall, and does it play into sentiment that, you know, Northrop has gone from being front foot to back foot at all, or is that just more sort of idle talk by folks out there in the ecosystem?
Yeah, I would say that's more idle talk by folks out there in the ecosystem. I would say from, you know, from an investor perspective, Lockheed needed another, you know, kind of, you know, big franchise program. And here you go, you got one. So that, you know, good for them. I think it did come as a bit of a surprise because the, you know, Northrop Raytheon, you know, for a missile defense program seemed like, you know, that's a pretty formidable team. However, you know, it went the other way. I think if you look at, as you spread it out over time, Lockheed's so big, it's an important program, but it doesn't move the numbers all that much. But you know, clearly, a positive win, a bit of a surprise, but I don't think it really changes the narrative all that much. I mean, in the end, you can't win everything, right? So, and it seems like Northrop's pretty darn busy as it is. You know, it's a good win for Lockheed.
Indeed. Sash, last question goes to you. FT is reporting that Prime Minister Sunak next week is going to announce, or soon going to announce, a new class of six warships to replace two large amphibious assault ships, Albion and Bulwark. Great names for ships, by the way. What's the program? What's the logic? And is it doable? Anybody who's been sleeping under a rock, or unless they've been sleeping under a rock, also knows that your brother is a noted defense analyst in his own right, who has basically raised all sorts of questions about what this would be and whether or not anybody's even going to be able to pay for it, even if both parties are saying they want to increase UK defense spending to 2.5% of GDP, which is terrific, assuming the Treasury goes for it. Anyway, bring us home on this.
Yeah, look, why no? Warships in name only. These are amphibious assault ships. They are, they're there to deliver an amphibious capability. But, you know, war fighting, these are not frigates. These are not destroyers. Point number one. Point number two, this is a wholesale replacement of the UK's amphibious fleet to replace two very large amphibs plus four smaller ones with a single class. Can it be afforded within the budget? No, it can't at the moment. But why is Prime Minister Sunak announcing it? This may come as a surprise to some of our readers, but there's a general election coming up in the UK. And when that happens, the two parties each try to outcompete as to who is stronger on defence, who's putting work in marginal constituencies, and so forth. So of course, that's why it's being announced now. But I would be very surprised if contracts are signed before the election comes. Whoever wins the election, and the polls say it will be Labour, but whoever wins the election is going to have to do a very, very quick but incredibly rigorous defence review. They can't afford to spend sort of 18 months pontificating and presenting at think tanks and rubbish like that. It's going to have to be very quick. And it, you know, if that decides then that defence spending will go up to 2.5% of GDP, the Treasury will have to find the money for it. 2.5%, right, by the way, does not deal with the issues of the US withdrawing, or at least, you know, reducing its commitment to NATO if, you know, former President Trump is re-elected. If that's the case, every European nation is going to have to go towards a 3% of GDP. But this is an issue for post-November. But, you know, amphibious assault ships, yes, it's nice to have. But when I saw the headline, I thought we were talking about the air defense destroyers. That would have been interesting.
It would have been interesting, indeed. And speaking of air defense, kudos to Ukraine for knocking down two Kinzhal missiles with their Patriots and a Tupolev Tu-22 bomber with a Soviet-era S-200 at a range of 185 miles. Well played.
Yeah, I mean, it shows what the Ukrainians can do when they have, you know, when they're given the equipment, when they have the equipment. Interestingly, they're doing a brilliant job of putting new technology into old systems. So the Tu-22 was almost certainly shot down by an old Russian developed S-200 missile, but they're putting Western radars tying them into it. Right. And they're literally jamming them together and getting great results out of it.
I think a lot like Germany after World War II, Ukraine after this war is really going to be a superpower in Europe if it survives Russia's efforts to destroy it as a functioning state. Gentlemen, thanks very much. It's an absolute pleasure having you guys on the program each week. Hope you guys have a terrific week and look forward to having you back on again next week. Thanks so very much. And thanks to the audience for joining us. We appreciate it as well. A quick word from our sponsors, the Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by Bell, HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. And check out our award-winning weekly podcasts, Cavas Ships, hosted by Chris Cavas and Chris Cervello, and sponsored by HII and GE Aerospace, who clear the fog on naval and maritime matters. The Downlink with Laura Winter, sponsored by TE Connectivity, who takes a thoughtful look at all things space. And our Air Power podcast, sponsored by GE Aerospace, that I co-host with JJ Gertler. Thanks very much. We'll be back again tomorrow for the Look Ahead segment with our friend Byron Callen of Capital Alpha Partners. Until then, have a great day.